I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 16th, and we have a lot to talk about. And today we're talking about something that doesn't get discussed often enough. We're talking about sex and MS with licensed clinical psychologist and the founder of Inclusivity Clinical Consulting Services, Dr. Linda Mona. Dr. Mona's clinical work is focused on providing services to people with disabilities within a disability-affirmative context, and she's been successful at promoting disability consciousness through her expertise, social justice advocacy, and her own lived experience as a disabled woman psychologist. As I talked with Dr. Mona, it became clear that when it comes to the subject of sex and MS, there's a lot to unpack. So rather than shorten our conversation, I'm dedicating this entire episode of Real Talk MS to the topic of sex and MS. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Linda Mona. A fulfilling sexual relationship with your partner can have a positive impact on your physical and mental health in a variety of ways. But studies suggest that about 80% of the people living with MS are affected by some sort of sexual dysfunction. Today, we're talking about sex and MS with my guest, Dr. Linda Mona. Dr. Mona is a licensed clinical psychologist as well as the founder and president of Inclusivity Clinical Consulting Services. She's been recognized by the American Psychological Association, the Academy of Spinal Cord Injury Professions, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality for her work focusing on people living with disabilities. Dr. Mona has published over 50 articles on disability in academic-related publications and has delivered over 100 workshops and seminars on the subject. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Mona.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
Multiple sclerosis is a disease that affects the central nervous system, our brain, and our spinal cord. And it's our central nervous system that mediates a person's sexual response. So I thought we could begin our conversation by having you explain the sexual response cycle and then help us understand how MS can impact this cycle.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So the sexual response cycle is a model. It's Masters and Johnson's model, actually, from many years ago in the 50s. And it's been modified in different ways, but it encompasses all realms of the physiological responses that our bodies go through when we become sexually aroused. And that starts with the brain. And so it might be a thought or something that comes through the brain that leads to desire. And that is, that person is really attractive, or I'm thinking about my partner, or we're going to have a good date. And that information comes through your brain and it then travels down your spinal cord and talks to your genitals. And so that's the relay system that is actually the end result of what we're talking about, the sexual response cycle. So we have desire, we have excitement, and that realm of the response cycle really looks at the early stages of a physiological arousal. So that could be, you know, somebody's body starts, to respond with women with lubrication and men with erectile functioning that starts to, you know, they start to see an erection. So it's those early stages, the early parts of our body. And then we get to orgasm, which, as we know, is the climax of everything. And then the last part of the sexual response cycle is resolution. And that's where, after you have this heightened response, which is basically a reflex, an orgasm is a reflex. And then after that is resolution, where the body kind of starts returning to its more quote unquote normative state. Now, the ways in which that MS or other chronic health issues can interfere with that is that the relay system that we originally talked about becomes impaired. And so somebody may really have that thought in their mind that they're feeling like their partner's attractive or they're wanting to have sex. And, you know, whatever they do, that message does not travel down their spinal cord and it does not reach their genitals. And so it becomes very frustrating to think, what is going on? And then that, you know, also becomes complicated by a partner not witnessing that person's arousal and wondering whether or not they still are attractive to that person. So it's the relay system, it's changes in physiological functioning, and then how that, in fact, affects the way somebody feels about themselves and their relationships with others.
As you mentioned, MS can interrupt and interfere with that sexual response cycle. And one thing we sometimes see in people living with MS is an apparent loss of interest in sex. So what are some options for someone who experiences a partial or total loss of libido or sexual desire?
So I think, you know, the first thing is to acknowledge that that does happen to many people. That is the actually most popular thing that is reported in the whole realm of sexual dysfunction or sexual disorders is lack of libido. So it's very common. It is related to our mood. It's related to medication. It's related to body change. It's related to a whole lot of different things. So when somebody comes in and talks about that and talks about missing it and really wanting that back, and their partner wants that as well, we try to think about ways to improve connection with their partner, or connection with their body. So for example, if somebody is feeling like, you know, that usually when an attractive person walks by them, they're like, you know, but they're noticing that that doesn't happen anymore, or they're not feeling drawn to other people, that, you know, we start to think about, well, let's get you back on track with this. Let's figure out what we can do as a treatment plan to help you become more connected with that. And that usually means helping people to feel more like themselves. And so that might be doing something that is pleasurable to them, that makes them feel attractive. It could be manicures, pedicures, it could be working out. And, you know, we all, disabled people, work out in different ways. And even though we may not work out the way that other people do, it still is a message that we are getting connected with our bodies. And I think it's also bringing the partner in to the degree that we can, if that person that we're working with or that person's talking about those issues is comfortable with that. Because if we can bring the partner in, we can engage that person in assisting with increasing you know, that desire disorder issue. And that might mean planning 10 minutes a day, kissing each other on the lips, you know, if people are open to kissing and that's easy for them, kissing them once a day. And I don't mean just a, you know, I mean a meaningful kiss, right? 10 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day, I'll take 2 minutes, whatever it is that person can do or manage to do. It could be a date night, right? And we know date nights have been influenced incredibly by the pandemic, but people have date nights at home. They might go on a drive. They might go get takeout and go park somewhere. So having a date night, having something that makes you feel special away from all of the other stress can help to ignite libido. And the more you do it, and the more consistent you are, the more successful you are with increasing that. It takes some time and it takes some commitment and some investment. But usually what happens is it becomes, in the psychology world, what we call reinforcing, because people are reminded of how much they love being intimate with somebody. And when you get away from that for so long, it's like, oh gosh, why did we wait so long to do this again? So I think that igniting that memory and bringing it back to the forefront is an important part of starting to work on that issue.
MS can sometimes affect someone's ability to achieve orgasm, or it can impact the frequency or intensity of orgasms. So can sexual activity still be pleasurable and fulfilling without an orgasm?
It absolutely can be just as fulfilling and just as pleasurable without orgasm, but it is different. There is a but. I don't know if it's a but or an and. It's different, right? Just because something different doesn't mean it's less or worse. It's up to that person to judge. But we do know that MS and other chronic health conditions interfere with the reflex known as orgasm, which is a release, or we say like a sneeze, right? There's a building up and a release. We can liken it to that physiological experience as well. And when people lose the ability to have an orgasm, it is very difficult. It's a difficult loss, like any other kind of loss that people are dealing with. But that loss is specific to pleasure, right? So, I mean, we lose functional ability in other ways, but that loss that's related to pleasure is very difficult. And trying to figure out what sex will be like without that heightened you know, the actual, you know, fireworks of the sexual experience is hard for people to wrap their heads around. And so what we do with, you know, what my response to that is that, you know, I will work with people on brainstorming what it is they like in their sexual interactions, how they typically, what they find pleasure in, and try to enhance those things in their relationship. And it's also to normalize that, you know, it really is different. There's no beginning and middle and end anymore if somebody's no longer able to have that climax. And so, you know, working with people on reconceptualizing what that means, it may be that you're engaged in a certain amount of sex play and, you know, and then it just kind of, you taper off, or you go by your partner's arousal pattern, or you fantasize about something that was once very pleasurable to you. But there's nothing in the rule book that I know of that says that everybody has to have an orgasm, everybody has to have sex the same way. We have to widen our beliefs on this. And we need to prepare people whose bodies have changed for this loss and how to adapt. Not adjust, because adjust, you know, that implies there's an end. We want them to adapt to this new way of being, and it's our job to help them figure out ways to do that.
To that point, there are some situations among couples affected by MS when intercourse is just not possible. How might these couples still have a satisfying sexual encounter without intercourse?
So, you know, and again, we go into like society's belief of what sex is supposed to be. And usually it's heterosexual, penile, vaginal intercourse. And I think people have sex in a lot of different ways. And so I think it's challenging those beliefs, and also acknowledging that, you know, a lot of people like having intercourse, right? And even when you ask heterosexual couples, they prefer missionary style, right? Which everyone's been trying to get people out of that missionary position for a long time. But why do they like it? They like it because of the face-to-face connection. And people long for that eye-to-eye connection with people. That's where that emotional connection comes in with folks. So I think it's about, you know, I think if people are no longer able to have intercourse, or they deprioritize having intercourse every time they have sex, we have to come up with other ideas. And that goes towards really speaking with that client and that client's partner about what it is they, what activities they like to engage in, which ones they don't prefer, and building up those ideas for them and helping them to work that into their new belief system on what sex is. So it might be sometimes it's holding hands or it's flirting. It could be laying each other's arms. It could be, you know, stimulation with hands. It could be stimulation with the mouth. You know, there are so many different things. There's no rules on what people could do. The only rule is what somebody feels comfortable with and what's okay or not okay with them.
There are some common issues that can get in the way of satisfying sex. So I'm wondering if you might share possible strategies for men who have difficulty either achieving or maintaining an erection.
So I think some strategies for men who confront erectile issues are really to kind of decide, you know, what, you know, how they want to approach it. It can be embarrassing, right? So whoever you talk to about it, you might want to go to your doctor, you might want to go to your urologist, and you might want to talk about a treatment strategy to help with achieving and maintaining erection. Some people who have chronic health issues, they can use any of the drugs that are out there that everyone else are using, and sometimes they're not able to. So I think it requires a conversation about what pharmaceutical options are appropriate for you. And if that's something you're comfortable with and something you're willing to try, then I think that is a good way to start. I think talking to your partner about it and talking about what, you know, what it is that you would like to do or what you're missing is a good initial conversation to have. And I think preparing for, you know, the erectile functioning to work sometimes and not work other times is really important. So I think you know, it's great if you, whether you have a pharmaceutical intervention or you're having a good day and it's working the way you want to, then let's just celebrate that. But know and prepare for, oh gosh, this just isn't working. This is not what I want. You know, my body is not behaving the way I need it to behave. And so what can we do instead? Have that plan in place in your mind. Okay, so we're just going to, we're going to switch a position here, or we're going to do something else, or I'm going to focus on my partner, or I'm whatever that might be, to have a strategy. Because what will happen is, is a feeling of sorrow and sadness and going back to that place of, I just can't do it. I can't do it the way I used to. I can't be me. And so if we can figure out an alternative in that moment, although not perfect, it's a plan in place to switch to get through that moment, and then look forward to other times where it might be better.
And what are some options for women who may experience decreased lubrication?
Women start lubricating at the first signs of arousal. So they start, even when they find somebody attractive, they'll start, we're talking about vaginal lubrication in the vulva area. And what happens with women is that lubrication occurs, but there's also blood that, the way that an erection happens is blood rushes into the penis, and women with arousal, blood rushes into the vaginal, the vulva area. And actually women's body ends up with heightened levels of arousal. They end up, their pelvic floor kind of tilts back and it expands. And that's called tenting. And that tenting process usually occurs with this gradual stage of arousal. So while we can help women pretty easily with lubrication, right? We have all different kinds of lubricants that are available to folks. And even some people can get it through a prescription or pharmacy if they don't have the money to pay for it. You can get it over the counter. That part can be more rectified in terms of applying that lubricant to the vulva area. But what's harder to assist with is that tenting process. And that's where people have to be careful in terms of having penetrative sex. Because if somebody's body is not as aroused, or perhaps as tented or open as possible, you could risk some vaginal tearing in the vaginal walls. So just want to make sure that lubricant is being used not just on the outside of the vulva, but also inside the vaginal area.
We've been talking about the physical manifestation of sexual dysfunction, but some sexual dysfunction happens in our heads. Our psychological, social, and cultural attitudes can impact how couples think about sex, and they can create real barriers to a fulfilling sex life. For instance, some people living with MS may no longer feel sexy or see themselves as a viable sex partner. What's the best way to manage these kinds of negative self-images?
Well, I think society's done a really good number on people with disabilities in terms of their perceived attractiveness and worthiness of others' attention. And so it becomes a battle with trying to work with people's perceptions on that. And I think it's important to know what somebody's perception is and to figure out a very respectful way of not just challenging those perceptions, but thinking that there actually might be other ways that people think about it. So it's actually not uncommon sometimes to have partners say, I still find you so attractive. I know you have this condition now, but you come across the room and woo, I'm ready to go. Right. So, and that can be mind-boggling to somebody living with a chronic condition who feels kind of damaged by things. So I think it's about challenging those beliefs, honoring why you feel the way that you do, and making room to thinking about things in a different way, thinking about those things that make you feel good. So is it, I don't know, some people like, scents, some people don't, right? Is it a certain cologne or perfume? Is it some way that a piece of clothing that you feel like you look good in? Is it, when you wear your hair in a ponytail, or for men having shorter hair or longer hair, whatever that is that makes you feel more like you, I think it's important to pay attention to that and to prioritize what those things are. That helps to combat that negativity. We're always going to be surrounded by negative beliefs about disability and difference. I wish that, I'm a pretty optimistic person, but I don't know that in my lifetime, I am going to see this rapid change. I think we've changed significantly, and disability is now intersected into so many different domains in life. But I still think that we as people with disabilities are perceived as less than and not as attractive. So I think, helping people to look at things differently, helping them to feel more about who they are and what their worth is to themselves and their partner in terms of that realm is really important.
About 50% of the people living with MS will likely be diagnosed at some point with depression. How does depression impact someone's sexual health, and what can people do to better manage it?
So depression is well known for preying upon people's libido and sexual desire. And sometimes, you know, depression is a result of that lack of libido or desire, or it causes it. So we have to ascertain exactly where that connection is. I think depression, you know, and anxiety, and both and depression and anxiety love one another. They hang out together sometimes. And so we have to look at those two components. And I think treating depression is really important. And we have, psychology has amazing treatment approaches for depression. We have cognitive behavioral therapy. We have acceptance and commitment therapy, which is an evidence-based strategy, which we use a lot with people with chronic health issues, because it's about kind of accepting and tolerating certain things and having this, what we call sometimes this radical acceptance of where life is. And once we do that, we can then move on and try to challenge other things in our life so that our mood improves. So I think there's increasing pleasurable activities in life. There are a lot of ways to treat depression through talk therapy. And there's also medication treatment. We know that with depression, medication and talk therapy get us our best results. Some people, you know, you have to go with what people want to do. Some people want to do medication. Some people don't. Some people want talk therapy. Some people don't. So it has to be based upon what that client wants. And we have to also keep in mind, though, that medication that can be used to treat depression and anxiety can also have sexual side effects. And so helping clients to weigh those things and weigh what is most important to treat at that point in time is important. If somebody is heavily depressed and we really need to prioritize that, then I would always recommend, like, let's prioritize, like, let's get you in a better place with your mood. And I think all these other things will fall into place afterwards.
You know, I often remind people that MS affects families, not just individuals. So what about the MS caregiver? Sex can sometimes lose its allure when a partner is feeling more like a caregiver than a sexual partner. What can you recommend for people living with MS and their partners when it comes to managing changes in their roles as partners and as lovers?
What a great question. And again, another one of those questions that people have a hard time addressing. We know that 80% of caregivers or people who give care are family members. And sometimes that's out of necessity, sometimes because for financial reasons, sometimes it's out of choice. Some people want their partners doing personal care for them, some don't. So it really kind of depends upon the logistics with that. There's lots of different scenarios that can come into place. For couples who are faced with that, I think going into that situation and having direct conversations about those change in roles are really important. There are some couples who kind of go in and out of those roles really easily and seamlessly, and there are other couples who have a lot of conflict with it. I think in general, right, when for those couples, even those who go through seamlessly with those change in roles, it's really important to make a demarcation of when caregiving begins and ends and when sex and intimacy begins. So, for example, I would not ever recommend that if a partner is assisting with bowel and bladder care, I would not recommend assisting in that and then 2 minutes later saying, let's have sex. Why is that? Because there needs to be some time to shift. I mean, I've actually worked with people where I've said, you know, this is going to sound really strange, but I try this out, right? When you're doing caregiving, you put a hat on. I don't care if it's a baseball hat. I don't care if it's a goofy hat. Put it on because you need some demarcation that you are no longer husband or wife and you are caregiver. And obviously you can't fully pull your partner status out of it, but it's some physical demarcation that that person is in a different role. And I think having that communication and having room for frustration around it is important. Having backup caregivers or caregivers other than family members, even though many people living with chronic conditions don't want that, or even their partners don't want that, I think it's important because people, you know, I think they're able to function better in relationships when they know there's a backup and there's a break that's given every once in a while. So I think, you know, having that open conversation, demarking those roles are really important because it can be all lumped into one. And then both that person living with the condition and the partner start thinking, are we still married? Are we roommates? Or am I just giving you care? Right. So I think couples do, you know, they also alternate. So it may be, you know, if you help your partner with certain things and you know they're running late and they're trying to get out of the house, you might help them a little more than what you usually do. They need to know what they can do on their own and what they need assistance with. So, and knowing again those boundaries of when it's okay to ask for more help and when it's not, and who do you have on the outside that can assist. But communicating constantly around that is really important. And it's really important to keep up those date nights and things that really put that physical and sexual intimacy on a pedestal. Because in a way that caregiving can be a threat. And we don't, if we know that there could be a threat to pulling away from that, we want to go eyes open into it and figure out a way to combat it.
Well, you've certainly made the point that communication is so important, and it's important for many reasons. But as often as we hear about the importance of honest and open communication, it's often easier said than done. What are some ways that people can have those meaningful and effective sorts of communication about sex with their partner?
Well, I always encourage people to set a time to have those conversations when they're not in front of the TV or they're not in front of their phone. You know, we're all so distracted these days with our devices that it's really important to put it down and to walk away from that and to create some time to have that conversation and not when other people are around. I mean, can it be during dinner? If that is a time that that couple typically talks about things, I think that is fine. But having something, you know, that is set aside to really have that discussion with less distractions is important. And I think it can start off with something as simple as, you know, I have something uncomfortable to talk about, or there's something that's on my mind, right? What does that do? That cues somebody that something's coming. Right? It lets that person kind of sit back in their chair and say, okay, what do I need to attend to? It gets that person's attention. And to have that, you know, discussion around, you know, I'm concerned about our sex life. It might be, I'm concerned because I just feel like I'm your caregiver. I don't feel like you think I'm attractive anymore. I think you just want me because you want me to take care of you. And it may totally not be what that person is thinking, but because there hasn't been a prioritization of emotional intimacy and physical intimacy, it's easy to jump to that. Our minds love doing that. Let's just jump to that conclusion. Well, you just want me as a caregiver. You don't want to have sex with me. You don't find me attractive anymore, right? So those things can just snowball. Anything we can do to deter the snowballing is really, really important. So having that discussion, prioritizing the conversation, I always think jotting things down. So when I'm training people about how to ask questions about sexuality, I actually have them practice in the mirror because I talk about it so much, I often forget how easy it is for me to talk about. And so I'll have trainees saying, well, I feel like when I said that word or I asked that question, it was much louder than other questions. So I'll have people practice in the mirror and say, it's probably not that much louder. You're just not used to saying it. So if couples are not used to saying it, it's okay to write down on a piece of paper and say, I have an uncomfortable question, or can we just talk about our sex life and, you know, and prioritize that discussion and then move forward from there.
Well, Dr. Linda Mona, thank you for elevating the conversation about a subject that we don't talk about often enough. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/181. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And now I have a favor to ask. It would mean a lot to me if you would leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS. Just point your web browser at realtalkms.com/review, and you'll see links to the different online destinations that you can choose from to leave that rating and review. Now, those links will be different for each of you because they're based upon the software that you happen to be using to listen to podcasts or the software you at least have installed on your phone, tablet, or desktop computer. For instance, if you happen to be using an Android phone to listen to Real Talk MS, then you won't see a link to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, because you can't leave a review on Apple Podcasts with an Android phone. I hope that makes sense. It's just a little bit of technology that makes leaving that rating and review super easy. So if you're able, I hope you'll take a moment to leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS, and you'll find a link to do that in today's show notes. Walk MS 2021 is coming, and this year, Walk MS will meet you where you are to connect, celebrate, and make a difference like never before. I'll be walking, and I hope you're planning to join me this year. You can learn more and register at the National MS Society's website, and I'll include a link to Walk MS information in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.